arrive. You may be seated. This is our first case and only case of today, this morning. People of the State of Illinois versus Roland Brialt. Would the counsel for the appellant introduce themselves, please? You have to remember, there's old guys up here. You have to keep your voice up. Well, there's at least one old. And for the appellee. Thank you. You may proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. We have raised four arguments in this appeal. If the court will permit, I will focus today's arguments on issues 1 and 3. Our first argument is that the state failed to prove Mr. Brialt guilty, specifically that the evidence in this case was insufficient to meet the state's burden of disproving beyond reasonable doubt that Roland Brialt acted in self-defense. The most crucial evidence in this case is the video. It was admitted as a joint exhibit by stipulation of the parties. Significantly, the state does not mention the video anywhere in their brief. As this court is familiar, there are 6 elements of self-defense that the state was required to disprove beyond a reasonable doubt. The only one remaining at issue before this court is whether the use of force was necessary.
Now, the fact finder was the jury. They saw the video.
Correct.
What did the state need to say about the video? Forgetting the other issues, understanding. They saw the video. They made their judgment as to what happened and to whether or not it was self-defense or if your client was the aggressor or became the aggressor. What are we to make of that? I mean, you're effectively saying, setting the other issues aside, you want us to reverse a jury verdict. That's a heavy, heavy burden.
It is, Your Honor. And the jury did, in fact, deliberate over multiple days. And on the second day of deliberations, they did note to the trial court that they were having trouble. They asked the court what they would do if they couldn't come to a verdict. But here, our argument is that the jury did make its finding. They were the trier of fact. We don't dispute, but that it was unsupported by the evidence. And that is, as I've mentioned, crucially, the video, also my client's testimony. And there was nothing that was not consistent with that account of events. The video was consistent, my client's testimony that he acted in self-defense. And then additionally here, the remaining eyewitness testified that she denied seeing even 1 second of the fight. She couldn't say who was punching who. And additionally, there was a forensic testimony, and the expert gave his firm, unrebutted opinion that the fatal wounds in this case would have taken very little force and that they had occurred where the two men were struggling and my client was on the bottom and Mr. Pendergast on top of him. So that was wholly consistent, again, with the testimony of self-defense and with the video. There was nothing that the jury heard here that would support its finding.
What about the fact that the jury sent that note out and brought to the attention that your client didn't have any wounds besides a little cut?
So that wasn't addressed by the trial court. That there was, in fact, evidence in the record that my client is the only one that had defensive wounds. And that was based on the evidence, the photographs, and the testimony of the forensic expert. So the jury, it's hard to speculate what that meant, but it indicates that they seemed mistaken on that because my client did, in fact, based on the evidence, have a defensive wound, the only defensive wounds of either of the parties involved. So on the issue of whether the use of force was necessary, the video shows the sudden physical nature of the encounter in this case. The size difference between the two men is apparent. The record shows that Mr. Pendergast was nearly 6 feet tall and 220 pounds, described as much bigger and stronger, and a difference of approximately 55 pounds, larger than my client. My client did not arm himself in anticipation of any altercation. There was no evidence that of any idea that anything was going to occur, and the record shows that he just routinely carried a pocket knife for work and carpentry purposes. Additionally,
I carried a pocket knife, but it would take me a lot longer to get it out and use it than your client did.
Perhaps, however, there is case law that we've cited that supports, especially where there is a size disparity, that in the sudden unfolding events, a defendant is not expected to be infallible in his judgment, that the issue is whether it was a reasonable belief. And here, the apparent danger of great bodily harm, again, based on the size, the use of force, and the video also contradicts any argument that Mr. Pendergast had backed off or withdrawn, because at the moment where my client is shown pulling the knife out of his pocket, first he does pull it out and hold it down by his side and push forward with the other hand, not with the hand holding the knife. And Mr. Pendergast is shown on the video at the same time making a beckoning motion with his hands. So apparently, appearing that he is engaged and committed to an altercation, not that he's backing off. And finally, going back to the forensic testimony, Dr. Bloom again testified that there was no evidence that Mr. Pendergast was, for example, trying to get away and stabbed from behind. He said there was nothing to support that.
But the video shows that there's a significant gap between them. Mr. Pendergast goes off the video, and then we just see your client pulling his knife out.
The video shows some distance. The testimony was that at that time, the hallway is only 3 to 3.5 feet wide. So with two men in it, a space of, I can't estimate, but certainly less than 3 feet, perhaps a foot, not a sizable distance. And the diagram, which there was a full model, but also the diagrams are contained in the record on appeal, shows the hallway that was the route to get to the door, the employee exit, where my client was able to exit the building, followed closely by Mr. Pendergast. So that at that point, both men moved off as they moved down the hallway. But when they reappeared, my client ran first and he was followed again closely. So we don't know what happened in those 15 seconds, but everything that is shown on the video is consistent again with my client's claim of self-defense. So considering
counsel, don't we look at, for purposes of review, don't we look at this in light most favorable to the state and determine whether or not a reasonable jury or in this case could decide otherwise?
Yes.
And doesn't that gap, as described by Justice Grishow, create a situation where a jury could make those determinations?
Well, again, our argument is that there is some slight distance on the video, but we know from the additional evidence that it was very small. And that, again, as the video shows, my client pushing forward, and we know from the diagram he had to get past to get down the hallway to the exit, that Mr. Pendergast is making the motion, appearing to be fully engaged still at that point. And it was the state's burden to disprove self-defense. And considering the evidence in this case, including the crucial video, we argue there was simply no evidence for the jury to rely on.
Counsel, let me ask you about that. It appears in your brief, I just want to have you clarify, you mentioned the six elements of self-defense, and it appears that you're arguing that the state has to disprove all six. But isn't it correct that if they disprove any one of those six, then the claim of self-defense fails?
Yes. And at this point, there's only one that's left in dispute on appeal. But yes, that is correct. So because the evidence in this case was critically weak, and particularly on the issue of self-defense, there were several errors, additionally, that we've argued were prejudicial and denied Mr. Brialt his right to a fair trial. In the minutes after the altercation, Mr. Brialt raced home, went straight to his landline, and called 911 because his cell phone had been damaged. The jury never heard the recording of Mr. Brialt telling the 911 operator, "Joe just attacked me. I need a police officer. I ended up stabbing him. I protected myself, and he is stabbed. He was going to kill me." The state successfully got this 911 call excluded pre-trial. Yet in its rebuttal argument, the state argued to the jurors, if this person was trying to kill him, would he have said he was trying to kill me? I had to defend myself. None of that comes out. Wouldn't you, in the heat of the moment, say he was trying to kill me? That's the first thing you would say. He was trying to kill me. Never says anything about that. Admits he never told the police he was scared or thought Joe was going to kill him. He never told the police these things. That's something he invented. All of those claims were made in the state's rebuttal argument.
Wait a minute. Those last remarks related to what he would have told the police. That's not got anything to do with the 911 call.
The argument, the state did mention, in part, the specifics from cross-examination of what my client had and had not said to police. So, yes, the prosecutor also included some comments about, you know, he didn't tell police specifically. He admitted that he didn't say he was gasping for air, was choking.
Well, is there anything wrong with that?
Not if it was limited, but here the state went beyond that and argued he never said these things. Wouldn't that be the first thing you would say? And then concluded that's something he invented. The state argued that for the first time, 8 years after the fact, my client made up this claim of self-defense and told it to the jury. And this misled the jury on what had actually occurred because the defense was barred from presenting the recording of the 911 call 6 to 7 minutes after my client left. And we know that because the recording was continuous and we can hear his drive home and walking directly and dialing 911. And this showed that my client did in fact say, as among the very first things that he said in the heat of the moment, that Joe had attacked him, he thought he was going to kill him, and he had protected himself. So again, the state was well aware of this recording because it was played in open court at the hearing, and the state had moved, had objected to it being presented and successfully got it precluded. So there was evidence the state was aware of that Mr. Brialt did not invent his claim of self-defense, and it was prejudicial for the state to comment on this excluded evidence.
I can't recall. Did they object to that when it was presented at trial?
There was no objection. We've raised this as a matter of plain error.
Thank you.
And we can meet that burden because it was a clear or obvious error, and also because the evidence was extremely closely balanced in this case. As we've, of course, argued, the evidence was insufficient, but certainly the evidence was closely balanced where the jury deliberated multiple days, again, expressed its difficulty, and there was no evidence contradicting my client's claim of self-defense. So this was the crucial issue, and due to the closely balanced nature of this, the prosecution's statements and rebuttal likely misled the jury on the crucial issue of self-defense and contributed to the jury's finding of guilt. And under those circumstances, plain error would apply. This was a prejudicial error, and we would ask this court to reverse, if not outright, on the reasonable doubt argument and to remand for a new trial. Based on this or the additional two issues that we have raised in our brief. Unless the court has further questions on any of these or the remaining issues, I would reserve remaining time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Brooks.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court and counsel. The standard of the reasonable doubt claim is that any rational trier of fact, viewing this evidence most likely in the light most favorable to the prosecution, could have found the elements proved beyond a reasonable doubt. And so one of these elements, because the defendant did meet their burden of production on a claim of self-defense, is whether the state must disprove the claim of self-defense beyond a reasonable doubt. They can do that by disproving any of the six elements of self-defense. And here, even the first element, whether or not the defendant was the aggressor, the defendant has failed on that point. Because under the White case, whenever a perilous situation arose from the defendant's own aggressive conduct, he cannot claim self-defense. Here, it's undisputed the defendant goes into the building where he's locked out. He sets off the alarm, And that prompts Kathy Dizek and her husband, Joe Pendergrast, to show up in response to an alarm. He knows he's going to set it off because he's been warned. He set it off before. He knows the code's been changed. He wanted to get the new codes. They wouldn't give him the new codes. There's a business dispute involving the partners at this company. There was a change of address made, and so they changed the codes on the alarm system. They put a padlock on the door, so he can't get in the server room to shut off the alarm. He even goes outside to try to cut the building's power, and when that doesn't work, apparently, because there's a battery backup. So this whole situation is the defendant's own making. So like in the Austin case where a defendant goes on...
So the jury has this background and understands this business dispute and why or what they infer the defendant is there for.
Yes, Your Honor. All this evidence is before the jury, so they understand the context of how this particular dispute in the hallway arose. There's also a situation where the defendant is going around putting his phone in people's faces at this business without their consent, they're objecting to this. They don't want this. So when he does this to Joe Pendergrast, that's an aggressive act, particularly also when he sees Joe, he says in an aggressive tone, "What are you doing here?" And so aggressive, even mere words can constitute enough to make someone an aggressor. But the whole constellation of facts here, the fact that he's setting off the alarm, knowing that Kathy's going to be there, and Joe doesn't want Kathy to go by herself, so knowing that the defendant was there. So they knew what this was all about. He's there. He's not supposed to be there. And so they show up. And then he says in an aggressive tone, like, "What are you doing here?" And then he's sticking his phone in his face. And that's when it gets swiped away. When Joe swipes the phone away, that's the first physical contact. But that doesn't mean that Joe was the aggressor in this overall situation.
Ms. Brooks, so I want to make sure I understand. So the state's position is that the defendant being the aggressor is the overall situation and not when he has the knife and there's been either a retreat or a separation of some sort between the person stabbed and the defendant.
Well, Your Honor, I would like to get to that part a little bit later. Yes, but okay. Yes, Your Honor, he also becomes an aggressor, even if you don't agree with my first argument about him being in the building and sticking his phone in the face and saying in an aggressive tone, "What are you doing here?" Even if you don't accept all that as making him an aggressor for these purposes, then he also, when there's that separation, charges, that was the word on 2478, he charged Joe. He had a knife. He did not think that Joe had a knife, but he charged towards Joe. And then he's also being cross-examined about that with respect to the video. And the 3399 on the record, very important part of the record, is a cross-examination of the defendant by the prosecutor with respect to this video. And the defendant's claim here is that he wants to go out the door that's behind Joe. Well, there's also an open door right behind him that he just went out minutes before, and he even admitted that. So he had a means of escape. If he is an initial aggressor, then he does have a duty to retreat. He can't charge at Joe with a knife because he wants to go out a different door that's maybe perhaps more convenient to him or some reason. He can't take that knife and charge at Joe. If Joe sees the defendant charging him with a knife, now Joe has a right to defend himself from the unlawful use of force. If they are separated, self-defense does not give you the right to charge at someone with a weapon, particularly when the other person is unarmed. One of the elements of self-defense they have to establish is that the defendant, that Joe was threatening imminent use of force. Well, I'm not sure. They said something about a little motion or something, like with his hands, but it's not like he's actively beating the defendant and then Joe, and then defendant takes out a knife and stabs him to stop the beating. They're separated at that point. So it's not necessary to take a knife and run at the person who just swiped a phone away. So, but my point about the initial aggressor issue is that even in the Austin case, so I'd say Joe swiping the phone away, even though that's the first contact between Joe and the defendant, that does not make Joe the aggressor legally, because in the Austin case, this was a case where the defendant goes on a bus. He's trespassing on the bus because he's not paying a fare. He's trying to steal a bus transfer ticket. And the bus driver then hits the defendant with a bus transfer punch. So that's the first contact in that case. But still, in the Austin case, that defendant who goes on the bus improperly and is trying to take bus transfer tickets illegally, that bus driver still is not the aggressor, even though they make first contact. And so that's the whole point, is that just swiping away the phone that's being stuck in your face, you're not allowed in self-defense to incite the use of force against yourself by doing something aggressive, like sticking a phone in somebody's face. If you do that and they swipe that phone away, then you can't pull out a knife and stab them and say, well, I was defending myself from a use of force. Well, first of all, self-defense also doesn't allow you to do anything in revenge. You're only protecting against further unlawful force. So even if it was a battery to knock the phone away, you have to have some other further threat of imminent use of force. And then the last element, which the defendant has to meet, because this case involves the infliction of deadly force by the defendant on Joe, it has to be objectively reasonable here. He's asking for full exoneration. So it just can't be an unreasonable belief. It has to be an objectively reasonable belief that in this situation, he has to objectively reasonably believe, actually subjectively and objectively reasonably believe, that Joe was not only capable, but intending to inflict death or great bodily harm on him. And that's a very important element in a self-defense case involving a deadly weapon. When the victim doesn't have a weapon out at the time, they're not threatening the defendant with a weapon, they're unarmed. And so is this person, admittedly, there's a little bit of a size disparity there, but is this person who apparently, like the Lacignol case cited in the state's brief, there's no history of animosity between these people. So it's not like he's been beat up before by Joe and he's like, oh, well, if he ever gets hands on me again, he's, you know, going to break bones or something. It's not like that. They have no history of animosity. And so that's a relevant factor to whether, if Joe swipes the phone out of the defendant's hand, does the defendant really believe that Joe is going to inflict death or great bodily harm on him with his bare hands? Is he even capable of that? Is he intending to do that? And how could a defendant subjectively, and not only subjectively, but actually objectively reasonably believe that Joe, at that moment, the defendant pulls out the knife, that Joe was capable and intending to inflict at least great bodily harm on him with bare hands? It is not reasonable. And when this court has to view the judgment in the light most favorable to the prosecution, then this court would have to affirm on the basis of the and reject the defendant's reasonable doubt claim. But especially if this court finds that the defendant was the aggressor, he doesn't have a right to self-defense. And also, he would have a duty to retreat under Section 7-4C1. And with that open door behind him, he could easily left through that door and not had to charge at the victim with a knife. With respect to the other argument, the closing argument issues, what the prosecutor here did was they referred to the defendant's statements to police. And they talked about what the defendant did not say. The defendant didn't say he was scared for his life or that he thought Joe was going to kill him. So he did not tell that part to the police. And so that was essentially a fair commentary on the evidence, and the prosecutor's entitled to talk about the evidence.
I agree, but what about the other part?
Well, the 911 call, see, they're likening this sort of a situation to the prosecutors exclude the 911 call on their motion. And then if the prosecutors had said, well, if this was really a case of self-defense, wouldn't the defendant have called 911? If they had argued that to the jury, then yes, that would be a problem because they knew the defendant called 911. They got that kept out of the jury. So, but there's no mention about 911 in the prosecutor's arguments. So it's not like they're criticizing the defendant for not having called 911 after stabbing Joe. So that's why it's not a clear, obvious error. It's certainly not prejudicial enough to constitute reversible error. This is a lengthy case and just a simple comment like that is when the defendant had a chance to talk to the police about what he thought Joe was going to do to him, and he had that opportunity, and that was all in the evidence. So, I mean, it's still a fair argument for the prosecutor to make about what the defendant did and did not tell the police about what happened. So that's why there's no actual mention of 911 in the prosecutor's argument. So to say that that was reversible error to talk about what the defendant did and did not say to the police, just because there happened to have been a 911 call that was not introduced into evidence because the prosecutor, because it was hearsay. That's what the defendant's second argument is. It was actually hearsay, and there's no abuse of discretion with that. So the defendant cannot admit self-serving statements because they're hearsay, and they're not admissible for the truth of the matter asserted. So for that reason, then, also whether the case was closely balanced, they're asking for reversal under the plain error rule. And so in order to constitute plain error, to be prejudicial under the plain error rule, the case has to be so closely balanced that this alleged error might have tilted the scales of justice against the defendant. But the case has to be close. Now, there is some, like, a little bit of closeness in one sense, and the defendant explains why he went down that particular hallway instead of going out the open door behind him. But it's still, objectively, he's rushing at the victim with a knife. So if that's on video and everything, it's not like he can argue that he's not aggressive in this situation, that he didn't become the aggressor by charging Joe with the knife. And so whether he's, the credibility, in other words, of the jury could have disbelieved the defendant, thought, well, maybe he was trying to get revenge for having his knife swiped, his phone swatted away. So he's going to charge at Joe with the knife and they're going to get into a physical confrontation. The jury could have thought that. They could have disbelieved the defendant's testimony. But essentially, the reason why defendant chose to go down the hallway towards the victim with his knife in his hand and an unarmed victim and then get into physical confrontation with that knife, the reason why, the credibility of that reason doesn't really matter. The defendant did that. So that's not disputed. So that's why it doesn't really matter why he did that. So any dispute or any closeness in the evidence, the closeness of the evidence mostly got to his mental state. So he's charged with murder. The jury can't really agree very well on that. They come back with involuntary manslaughter. So if anything, the trouble reaching a verdict might have to done with the defendant's mental state and reason why they ended up on involuntary manslaughter instead of murder. So in that case, they're not necessarily closely balanced. No, you can't cite the jury deliberations for the reason why they might have trouble reaching a verdict when they're trying to use that as evidence of, well, maybe they were a little hung up on the idea of whether this was self-defense or not. Well, it could have just been that they were unsure as to the defendant's mental state. And so therefore, he's not guilty of knowing murder. They find him guilty of a reckless crime like involuntary manslaughter. And so if that's the situation, then the jury deliberations really don't help them. But it really just comes down to the powerfulness of the evidence in the record. There is a video. The defendant charges. He's also responsible for setting up this whole situation, acting aggressively. And so for that reason, to say that he somehow that is close on the issue of whether he should be completely exonerated for this stabbing, it's not close. And that's why he cannot show meet the requirements of plain error with respect to his issues. And this court should affirm. I'd entertain any other questions.
You haven't said anything, something that counsel for the defendant said about size differential.
Yeah, I did, Your Honor, I did mention, I said I thought there was some size differential with respect to whether the defendant, it would be reasonable for the defendant to, objectively reasonable for the defendant to believe that Joe was capable and intending to inflict great bodily harm without being armed himself. Joe didn't have a weapon that he was using there. So if the size means that Joe's more capable of making great bodily harm, he still has to show that it's objectively reasonable for the defendant to believe that Joe was intending to inflict at least death or great bodily harm without a weapon. And when there's no animosity previously between the two of them.
Well, what, isn't the animosity inherent in him feeling that he needs to go with his wife back to the business to protect her, stand up for her, or confront this guy that's there without permission?
I don't believe it's like a violent sort of situation.
I just said animosity. I didn't say violent.
I mean, this is a contentious, I would just say this is a contentious business dispute. It's going to litigation. They're trying to dissolve the partnership. It seems like Joe can understand why he'd want to be there for his wife, who has to go turn off the alarm and reset it because the defendant happens to be there after the business is closed. I think it's fair to think that a husband would want to support a woman who has to go do that after a business is already closed. And there's another man there who may be causing trouble. But that doesn't mean that they've ever had any history of violence. It's not a situation where you can reasonably believe that this person, Joe, is going to intend death or great bodily harm, just because the only thing he's done at that point is swatted his phone out of his face. And that seems like the thing that anybody might want to do if somebody stuck a phone in your face in a contentious situation. So it's not to think that Joe was somehow displaying an intention of inflicting extreme violence on the defendant, but just simply not wanting the phone in his face. And that's, at that point, all he had done before the defendant charges him with a knife. So that's why you can't, it's not objectively reasonable to believe that you can inflict deadly force against an unarmed person. It's very limited. You can't just stab somebody who is unarmed to death and then claim self-defense when it's not objectively reasonable that that person was not only the Joe would have had to be the aggressor in that situation, would had to have imminently threatened physical violence against the defendant, illegally physical violence, but also intended and be capable of inflicting at least death or great bodily harm without a weapon. And that's just not reasonable under these facts. So anything, other questions?
I see none. Thank you.
Thank you.
Rebuttal.
The state argues that my client was the initial aggressor, again, for the first time on appeal. And as we've argued in our reply brief and cited the Supreme Court case in Henderson, when a prevailing party has made a concession or they can't raise an argument that's inconsistent for the first time on appeal. And here, at the conclusion of all of the evidence, the trial court said the facts that the court saw showed the decedent was the initial aggressor in this case. And the prosecutor said, this was discussing the jury instructions, that the defendant was not the initial aggressor, agreeing, and then argued it wasn't relevant. And the court said, I think it would be relevant. If the defendant is not the initial aggressor, he has no duty to retreat. Am I missing something here? And the state said, no, okay, I'm sorry. So after the conclusion of the evidence, the parties agreed that there was no evidence my client was the initial aggressor. And
where is it in the record that they agreed?
At page 3556. And we say the state agreed because the court said there was no evidence, no duty to escape based on the evidence it saw. The state said the defendant was not the initial aggressor. So they expressed their agreement with that. It goes on to the following page, 3557 as well. But in addition, several of the things that the state argues are my client's right to be there. Well, my client was a vice president of this business and he routinely worked there. And the alarm codes were removed. There was evidence without any court order. So there was no basis to remove him from the building. So the state's argument fails that my client didn't have a right to be there. And I've already addressed any argument that my client became the initial aggressor, again, because of the video. And as I've discussed, the moment 26:13 to 26 minutes and 17 seconds, where it shows my client pull out the knife and hold it by his side, and it shows the decedent curling his fingers in a beckoning motion. There's no indication that he appeared to back down. He moves off the screen, but my client moves off the screen as well. The state also, and I've addressed in the reply brief, that the state mentions there was an open door, but that is not an exit. There's a doorway that my client could have moved through that goes further into the building. And if he had taken a different route and gone through a different door, but there was testimony extensive from the architect who made the model in this case, that the only door that my client could have pushed to exit in an emergency is the one that he exited through. The closest exterior door, if my client had gone through the doorway, as the state suggests, there was a storage room that it was testified was very full, and then you needed to use a key in the lock to exit. So again, this was a moment of 15 to 30 seconds, and my client isn't charged with, you know, running through all of the possibilities of the closest or the best route of escape, but he did in fact escape through the door that was the only one he could push in an emergency. The state, in regards to the third argument, makes a distinction that the prosecution did not use the words 911, but that is a distinction without a difference. First, a jury wouldn't be expected to distinguish between 911 and police officers. And in fact, in Davis versus Washington, the United States Supreme Court noted that if 911 operators are not themselves police officers, they're agents. The concurring separate opinion used the term interchangeably, police and 911. But more than that, as we've argued, the prosecution went beyond simply talking about what my client didn't tell police at the police station, where he had explained when he was questioned. They didn't get into all of the details and blow by blow. It was a bigger picture conversation. But in closing argument, the state said that my client never said those things and asked the jury, in the heat of the moment, wouldn't they have said these things? He feared for his life when they knew, in fact, that he had said those as some of the first things that he said.
Counsel, I want to go back and ask you about this initial aggressor. And you keep saying that the state agreed to that. Now, this is kind of going to dive into the jury instruction issue. But the fact that the state wanted that other jury instruction, doesn't that reflect that there is no agreement that about the aggressor issue? Doesn't that show there was never an agreement?
It doesn't in this case. And that's because when the state, so if I can step back for a moment, the court initially denied the right. initial aggressor instruction because the court said that it didn't see any evidence to support it. And when it was revisited, the state did not raise the argument that my client was the initial aggressor, that there was evidence to support that. The state argued that they should be allowed to submit to the jury that Mr. Pendergast, if he was the initial aggressor, that the jury should consider that and whether he had a chance to withdraw or things like that. Well, that is not, and we've cited cases in our brief, that is not the inquiry for the jury. The jury is only evaluating the defendant, whether he was the initial aggressor. It's not inquiry. Its inquiry is not whether the decedent or anyone else was the initial aggressor. It's limited to the defendant. And that is why the state's position on appeal is still inconsistent, because it never raised an argument below that my client was the initial aggressor. So the reason that was given for the jury instruction based on whether or not Mr. Pendergast was the initial aggressor was incorrect. And the state doesn't raise that on appeal. And that is part of our argument, why we argue the jury instruction was given an error.
Okay, thank you.
So unless the court has further questions, we would rely on the arguments made here today and in our briefs. And we would ask this court to find, based on review of all of the evidence, that the state failed to disprove beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Brial acted in self-defense, and to reverse his conviction for involuntary manslaughter outright. In the alternative, we ask this court to reverse and remand for a new trial because he was prejudiced by errors that likely contributed to his conviction, the exclusion of his statements on the 911 call as excited utterances, the misleading rebuttal argument, and the improper jury instructions. And because this was a closely balanced case, these errors all went to the issue of self-defense and likely contributed to his conviction. Thank you.
Thank you for your arguments, counsel. We'll take this matter under advisement and rule in due course.